That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Mic on. That's a good start. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's version of That Money Show. I'm your host, Gabriel, aka That Money Guy, and we are here to talk all things about money. We're going to be discussing the economy. We're going to be discussing the questions you are too embarrassed to ask, the questions you've always wanted to know the answers to. And most importantly, I actually think, in my opinion, we're going to be having two incredible guests on this week. Number one, we've got Bobby Segal. He is a celebrity maths expert. We're going to be talking all things maths and numeracy when it comes to your education. And straight after, we've got Ben Askins. He is a content creator. He is the co-founder of Gaia. And most probably, you have noticed him through Toxic Bosses. You know, that thing where he goes in, looks at some horrible situations that you might have encountered at work, and he absolutely goes in on those people. What a show, what an incredible time. But let's dive straight in to what is going on in the economy. The truth is, quite a lot, especially in the UK economy. And like I said, on this show, what we look to do is we look to break it down so that you might be reading the news, or you might not be interested in the news. So you think that you're not going to spend time reading it, you know, you don't want to devote that time, or if you do read it, you end up not understanding it. Well, it's time to completely dispel that. It is time to actually give you the answers that you want to know. So what's up first? Well, the first news story that I want to share with you is actually very broad, because it is about the general economy, the state of the UK right now. Well, you see what is going on? Well, the economy grew in February by 0.1%. So what? What does that mean? What does that matter? That's a good question, and I'm going to dive into that in a second. But generally, what does that mean as opposed to kind of the history, what's been going on over the past few months, etc., etc.? Well, at the last quarter of 2023, we had negative growth. That meant that if we had another quarter, a quarter being three-month period, where we had negative growth again, we would have something called a recession. And that rings a lot of bells and alarm bells and negative things when it comes to, you know, previous thoughts of 2008 and COVID and all that kind of stuff, you know, a negative downward spiral of the economy. But the good news coming out of the Office of National Statistics is that we're actually up in February, 0.1%. I believe it's actually 0.3% up as well in January. So it kind of looks like we're coming out of that dip. You know, we're starting to see this kind of light at the end of the tunnel, a recovery. Britain is growing again. We're getting stronger again. All good things. We're turning this corner. I think there's one quote here that says that what this is a welcome sign. This is from Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor. It's a welcome sign that the economy is turning a corner. So a lot of you might have heard that. Great. That's the news headline. Again, can you break this down for me? I mean, that's literally what I told you I would do on That Money Show. So I'm going to do that for you now. GDP. What's going on? Well, that's the measure of gross domestic product. Question marks. People still confused about what's going on? Because I am. So let's break that down again. What is it and how is it measured? Well, it's taken from a measure of several things. One being the output of the country. So imagine, you know, the goods, the services being produced by the entire economy, by businesses, large, small, medium, you name it, they're measured. The second one that's measured is the expenditure. How much spending is being done in the economy? Are people spending money? Are they going to the shops? Are businesses spending money? All that good stuff. And the last one is on income. You know, wages, how much is being paid, etc., etc. So they take those three, they plug it into their magic calculator, and they can measure as to whether, when you compare it to other periods, whether it be last month, whether it be this time last year, has the economy grown or has it shrunk? Right now, we're growing. 0.1%, okay. Yeah, I agree with you. It sounds absolutely tiny. But to avoid a recession, it just needs to be a positive number. And to me, 0.1%, I don't know about you, sounds like it's higher than 0%. So it's good. We're going in the right direction, especially because we were all worried that we might be falling into another recession. Now, what are the benefits of growth versus, you know, this idea of recession? What's actually so bad of it? Well, when you've got a period of growth, it's the idea that, you know, the country is spending, there are going to be more jobs available, the government are going to be collecting more taxes. Obviously, when people spend more money and earn more money, the government get more money. And what they can do with those increased taxes is they are able to then reinvest that into the economy. So all those potholes that you've got down the road, hopefully they can get fixed when the economy grows. And when the economy shrinks, the opposite is true. So when it's shrinking, you normally see, you know, massive job losses. You see companies start to go bankrupt. You see the government pulling back spending. And in some cases, they need to start increasing taxation levels because they aren't actually, you know, getting enough money in to do the things that they promised they do, to even do the things that they need to do. So in every case scenario, a recession is bad and growth is good. I mean, it sounds really obvious, but a lot of people just ask the question, like, why does it matter? Even 0.1%, how does it actually affect the everyday person? And that's exactly it. It's this idea that hopefully, like I said, governments are going to keep spending on us. They're going to be spending more on us. Hopefully, you know, jobs are going to be going up. There's going to be more job opportunities for the country. Wages are going to keep going up and all that kind of stuff. So we want growth. We want that very, very much so. There is a little bit of opposition. The Labour Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has argued that Britain is worse off with a low growth and high taxes. And the Conservatives, she said, the Conservatives cannot fix the economy because they are the reason it is broken. This isn't the politics show. You can also get that on FUBAR as well, if you would like to, for commentary on that there. For now, I will stay out of it and I will let Rachel Reeves say her comments and we will allow her and Jeremy Hunt to argue it out. I'm going to take the fifth, plead the fifth and say no comment whatsoever. So that's the economy for now. What else is going on in the news? Well, the second story that I want to share with you is actually something that's come from a specific bank, a specific company, Lloyds Bank. So Lloyds Bank customers are now able to open a ready-made pension through their mobile banking app or internet banking. No, this isn't an advert that hasn't been sponsored. This is just something that was revolutionary that Lloyds are bringing to the market. And you know, when banks do something good, it's worth shouting about it, because often we think that, you know, banks are so slow moving, you know, all the legacy banks, your Barclays, your HSBC, your Halifax, we can name them all. And often they're very slow and they're not bringing in these new practices that maybe some of the challenger banks, you know, you've heard them, Monzos, your Revolutes, are starting to do. These things that actually are making kind of the products and the services that we're using, you know, the banking apps, bringing them into the 21st century, making them actually relevant for, you know, 2024, the year that we're in. Whereas, you know, those old banking apps feel completely out of touch. They make you not even want to use that bank in the first place. So what is this that they're doing? Because we're going to shout about it. They're doing something that's good. So they have teamed up with Scottish Widows to launch an app-based pension service called Ready Made Pensions. And it basically allows people to consolidate up to 10 existing pensions that they might have into one new pension pot with, like I said, the partnership with Scottish Widows. This is great. So the statistics coming out of pensions full stop right now, to give you a bit of context, is that 80% of those people that are employed are paying into their pension. Yeah, so that means 80% are doing something with their pension. Doesn't matter how much, they're putting something into it. Whereas when it comes to self-employed people, of which that is a category I fall into myself, 20% of us, only 20% of us are currently putting money into our pension. I mean, it kind of makes sense. Think about it. If you're self-employed, yeah, whatever you're earning, you're probably wanting to reinvest that into your business. You need to pay your salary, you know. Money's probably a lot more kind of tight, yeah, you're worried about your cash flows, etc. So maybe a pension is right at the bottom of your list of priorities. I do pay into a pension, even though I am self-employed, so I fall into that 20% group of people that pay into their pension as a self-employed person. And I would actually highly recommend people who are self-employed, or if you fall into that 20% of people that are employed but don't pay into your pension, to start strongly considering it, because the earlier you start, the more happy you will be, the more grateful you will be when you finally retire. Because who knows, when you get to retirement age, especially someone like me, who knows what age retirement will actually be? And B, who knows what kind of support we'll be getting from the government? Who knows if we'll even be getting, you know, that nice little bit of payout, what's it, around £10,000-£11,000 a year that government pensions currently cover? We have no idea, because for me, that's about 40, 50 years away, and we don't even know which government will be in power at that point. So back to this product that Lloyds Bank are putting out. Like I said, you can kind of consolidate 10 products into it, 10 old pensions into it, which is, you know, really useful. You don't want to have your pension scattered all over the place. You might end up losing one. Not that saying that it can't be found. So if you have ever lost a pension, this is your CTA. This is your call out right now to go and find that pension, to get a record of it. There are services online. Just look up how to find an old pension. There are government websites. There are private companies that can help you find your old pension. So this is a call out. But then you can go onto Lloyds Bank and they have ready-made products for you, which is really revolutionary because there's no other bank. This is the first large bank that offers something like this, where you can kind of go in and dependent on what age you are, you can start to pick and to choose your pension. Well, they'll kind of build that product for you. No decisions. You don't need to make any decisions whatsoever. They're making your life as easy as possible. And the truth is, when it comes to this kind of story, as much as obviously we want to dive in and maybe discuss the details, I think the thing that I want to pull out from here and the thing that I want you to be aware of is that it's really time for these big banks to start coming into the 21st century, to start providing products that help the everyday person with their personal finances. Pensions are huge. So many people don't really understand them, obviously don't understand the necessity of them and all that kind of stuff. Whereas, you know, when banks can provide services that make this easy, they make like with a click of a button, you can start paying into your pension and you can consolidate all of your old pensions from all those old businesses that you had, all the old companies that you worked for. Again, just making your life more simple. I mean, think about how, I'm not going to say anything specific, but if you are a member of any of these challenger banks, you can go into your account and you can start to see, you know, your breakdown of your expenditure. You can start to do multiple things, transferring money abroad really cheaply. You know, they give you a card that gives you a really low FX fee as well. You can maybe start to invest on those platforms. You can start to budget on those platforms. And it's kind of like a one-stop shop for everything that you need with your personal finances. These are the things that I think we need to be considering slightly stronger, because as much as a kind of a personal finance freak that I am, where I have an app for everything, yeah? So I've got my current account app, I've got my investing account app, I've got my saving account app, I've got my budgeting app. Imagine a world where you could have everything in one place. I mean, the headache that it would like take away from me. I know that kind of sounded weird. I was going to say the headache that it gives me, but it's the opposite. It would alleviate so much stress from me as someone who knows what they're doing with personal finances. And on the other side, for people that are avoiding a certain subsection. So maybe they've got the current account, they've got the saving account, but they haven't thought about investing and they haven't thought about pensions. Well, if that one app that you're using on a daily basis was kind of all consolidating it into one place, wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't that help everyone with their personal finances and make us all stronger and start to think about all of the categories rather than just the ones that we're currently bothering with? That's kind of something that I want to kind of challenge, put out there to the big banks, the what's predominantly known as the slow movers in the game. And if they are slow movers, then perhaps it's time for you to look at some challenges and see maybe these new guys, the new guys on the block that are offering, you know, a more visionary product, a more wholesome product is right for you, because you shouldn't be ignoring these things just because you don't know which app to have and it's all over the place and it's messy. You should be coming and seeing a one-stop shop. It makes complete sense in 2024. We have it for everything else, all other areas of our technology, right? You know, you go on your phone and you've got all of your different, like, I don't know, streaming providers on there. Might have been a bad example, but the whole idea is I think consolidated apps and products will help improve personal finances dramatically, because it'll help us not ignore the things that are necessary in our life. Run over from me. Sorry about that. I probably got a bit red in the face and all of that kind of stuff. For those of you listening, for those of you watching, you saw me get red in the face. But yeah, I am passionate about this and I do kind of want these financial services and providers to, you know, be supporting us and helping us on our personal finance journeys rather than making it more complicated overall. That kind of brings it to the end of the Economy Blitz. Like, you could call it the Economy Blitz, or you could call it the Gabriel Gets Angry with the Financial State of This Country Blitz. But coming up straight after this, I'll be taking a breather and then be speaking to Bobby Seagull, celebrity maths expert and chartered accountant. It's going to be a great chat. We'll see you then.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
FUBAR Radio presents What the
Health with Gabby Allen. Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl
Sobriety. Society.
I need to know what is so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it, like I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip, but actually we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling, so for me to place a bet on there would be pretty,
you know,
pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke. And I said I would, because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral
standing. We should also talk about
standing.
Cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Yeah. Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show with That Money Guy. Very excited to introduce you to our next guest. But first, let me just remind you of where we were before the break. We were talking about this kind of shallow recession that we were slowly coming out of. You know, in February, we started, well, last month, 2 months ago now even, we started to come out of it a little bit. Very small kind of growth. And we were talking, everyone's known about interest rates and GDP and all these kind of numbers, which is the perfect place to bring in celebrity maths teacher and chartered accountant, Bobby Segal. Welcome to the show. Very nice to have you here.
Pleasure to be on your show. Loved the first episode, by the way.
Thank you very much. Well, like I said to you before, hopefully the second episode will be just as good. I mean, let's start in straight away, okay? So you are, I suppose, like we said, you teach maths a lot, financial numeracy, and you kind of advocate for all that kind of stuff. When it comes to this news, what's your opinion and how do you feel that, you know, the general public listening to this should approach that topic?
So obviously GDP is, you know, despite, you know, I think there are flaws about it, it's the best indicator we have for how an economy is doing. We had technical recession, 2 quarters of negative growth. So the fact that we're looking to see the green shoots of recovery is good news. But I think if you look at most people, you ask people on the street, speak to my parents or my friends or my students, a lot of them do say that they're still feeling the pinch from, you know, years of below inflation pay rises, cost of living gone up, even though inflation is reining in. Prices don't come down very quickly. They go up quickly, but they take a while to come back down, if at all. So I think it's a good sign, but I think it would take a while for it to translate into people feeling more confident about the economy.
Yeah, well, one thing that people, I suppose, need to understand is that even though inflation figures are coming down, which is good, people know inflation, prices go up, etc., those previous inflation figures are now factored into everything that happens. So when you hear we're only going up at, you know, 3-4% now, A, that's still going up, so prices are still going up, and B, the 11% you heard about hasn't been eradicated.
Yeah,
that's now just factored into the price. So it's gone up 11% for 1 year and then 3% up the next year. So it's kind of a spiraling effect. And I think people sometimes forget that. They think that we're out of this and everything's going to go back to normal. Unfortunately, unless things drop in price, we are in a new normal. I don't know. So that's kind of the idea about the pinching effect. How would you go and translate this, I suppose, because you teach in a lot of schools, younger people.
Yes.
Do they care? Are they interested? And how can we make them interested in the topic and make it more relevant to them?
So the young people, again, I'm a maths teacher, been teaching in secondary and sixth form for a decade, and I work with primary schools as well. Most people, if you ask them maths, they're like, oh, grown sir, Pythagoras, trigonometry, when do we need it? But if you tell them about, you know, you want to earn money, you want to have a, you know, buy a house, get a car, they're like, yeah, their eyes light up. And they know how important it is. So it's one of those things where there needs to be better money education generally. And again, what you're doing is brilliant. Again, one of the things I find with young people is that with money, in school, maybe it's the fault of the GCSE curriculum, it's not done very well at all. But my young people, where do they consume information? I mean, a bit at the BBC, I wish, but it's their parents. Actually, it's social media, TikTok and Instagram. So again, I wish I could say they learn more from me than from guys like you. But the reality is they learn more from social media. In fact, sometimes students, especially I remember in crypto, they're like, oh, sir, it's like 2020. Have you seen this Dogecoin going up, sir, like 20% yesterday? But they're learning from social media. So they want to learn. So young people have an appetite to learn, but I just feel as if there's this imbalance where schools currently, we can only deliver what the curriculum has. So they're not learning what they need from schools right now.
Well, that kind of brings me on to a really important topic is what can schools do at this point in time? How can we start? Because there's a statistic that says our financial attitude is set as just 7 years yes. old, which is a really scary one, which means that we need to not just be going into high schools to educate about money, but be going into, what's that, year two?
Yeah, year three.
And I can't even imagine what those lessons would even look and feel like. So what are the topics that you would want to bring into schools or that schools are slightly or slowly integrating into their, you know, curriculum, even if it's not part of, you know, the main maths, physics, you know?
Yeah. So the way it currently works is that in theory, maths teachers are responsible for financial education. Maths teachers and PSHE, personal, social, health, education. But what often happens, it ends up falling between the cracks. Because if it's not the responsibility of one department or the other, I know in a school, you know, like, oh, it's the PSHE teachers. Oh, no, it's the maths teachers. And then sometimes, you know, my own schools, when I've taught, the money education is like one day of the year. And then those kids come in, yeah, they're like, it's a day off. Like, no, it's not a day off, it's a day you're learning. And they know it's important, but money education shouldn't be something that's taught just as a, oh, here you go, it's Christmas. You know, like a dog isn't for Christmas, it's for life. Mm-hmm. Money education is not just for a one-off PSHE day, it's for every single week, every single day. So I think it's the best education I've seen when money has been delivered well at schools is where they drip feed it into the curriculum. So it's like, once a week in a PSE lesson, once a week in part of your maths, once a week when you're looking at English and you're studying a play, again, if you're studying, I don't think, what's a play based in the 1920s? An Inspector Calls. And that's about the economic depression. Kids can learn about the stock markets there. So I think it's the best education is when it's drip fed, small and regular, almost like compounding, small and regular beats a one-off day once a year.
I couldn't agree more with everything you've just said. This idea that you were giving me flashbacks to my PSHE lesson because you do genuinely feel like, oh, yeah, we've got a free period now, basically. Yeah. Or we're going to discuss, you know, those taboo topics like mess about with because technically the teachers are going to take it serious. And it's just not the way that financial education can be given because it's such an important and fundamental aspect of your life. Like, obviously, when you're 15 and 16, you're not going to take it seriously. Mm. You don't have an income, you know, you're probably relying on your parents for any kind of finances, etc. So it's not a stress or a worry for you. But the thing about money is that the moment you get to 18 or whenever it is that you start to earn or move out, it's not like it's like a tap that you can slowly turn on. You're hit, you're slapped in the face with having to understand finances. And you either do understand it or you struggle and you don't understand it, which is like what you said, this idea of compounding. It's like the most magical word in everything to do with money. We can dive into the other aspects of it. But I like it in the way you described it with education. If you can drip feed it in, it's not just, you know, Sally buys 47 watermelons for £1.20. The question after that is normally, why does Sally need so many watermelons? It's not how many watermelons. Like, does she like end up? I don't even know what the questions were at that point. But those are genuine GCSE questions.
Yeah.
And they are so irrelevant from finance. I want to kind of switch it up a little bit, mm-hmm. but not too much at the same time, to move from finance and financial education to maths. Mm. Because you are an ambassador for the National Numeracy, which kind of aims to help children, obviously, with numbers.
Yes.
And this idea that maths is for everyone, mm-hmm. and we need to make everyone confident with maths. Because whether they like it or not, in their adult life, right, you're going to have to deal with numbers. And it's not one of those subjects like, for example, I don't know, history, where, okay, if you're not interested in history and that's not your passion, okay, maybe that you don't need to really learn too much about it. There are still essential lessons from that, but, you know, I'm kind of summarizing. Why is maths so difficult for so many?
It's a great question. So, in fact, I'm doing research at the University of Cambridge about maths anxiety, what makes people afraid of maths. And I think part of the issue is the way maths is taught, and this is going to be difficult to change in the short to medium term. But again, if you think back to your primary school maths lessons, you get given a list of questions, times tables, fractions, and you either get it right or wrong. Whereas in an English lesson or history lesson, you know, the teacher might say, oh, Gabriel, add a few more similes and metaphors. And you're like, oh, fine, I'll add that, miss. Whereas in a maths question, if you misunderstood how to multiply fractions, cross, 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 cross. So people, even if you are getting close to the method, people have this vision of themselves from quite a young age, 5, 6, 7, whether they are a numbers or a maths person. And that imprint lasts for decades. And they almost pass it on to their children and their grandchildren. They think, oh, you know, I don't have a maths brain, so therefore my son or daughter doesn't have a maths brain. But what I've always professed is that maths is a skill, like driving, like dancing, like baking. Obviously, we know in the real world, there are some people that, you know, there's the bell curve, the normal distribution. Some people are quicker at certain things. You know, some people, if you're playing football, you know, can pick up certain skills. Some people can learn to dance quicker. But all of us, I think for the majority of subjects, including maths, can learn to be competent. We're not asking people to be sort of Albert Einstein-esque level geniuses to be mathematicians. We want people to feel confident and competent using numbers on a day-to-day basis. And again, if you're someone that's afraid of maths at school, when they get their first payslip or they're applying for a loan or looking at a mortgage, these people are like, oh my God, they just cover their eyes and they're just hitting and hoping. And if they're hoping that their bank statement balances at the end of the month, but life shouldn't have to be that way.
So like you kind of alluded to at the end point, that idea of getting rid of maths and numeracy anxiety leaks so much into the financial world, right? Because at the end of the day, if you had to pick the actual practical world application of what you're going to do with numbers at the end of your education, it is money, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. Okay, you know, there might be, you know, a little bit of here and there, counting chickens in a park. I don't know. Obviously, that's not a thing. But it's the numeracy. So when you've got that numeracy anxiety, do you see that completely drip feeding into financial anxiety?
I think I see this a lot with the parents of my students. Because I'll meet them, again, normally once a term or once a year, and you meet the mum or dad, and they'll look at their son or daughter's grades in maths, and they're like, oh, I couldn't do maths at school, but don't worry, I'm still around, haha. And then they'll also tell me issues about they don't understand these are adults who are managing families. They don't fully understand their banking, their interest rates, their mortgages, what does GDP mean? And these things impact them on a day-to-day basis. And often that stem of that issue came from their school experience. And it's a real shame because, you know, like, if you think about fitness, for example, many people didn't necessarily like PE at school. Do you remember, like, did you have the weird gyms and the weird, like, equipment?
Yeah, I remember the plimsolls for me. Giving me, like, a flashback that isn't in a positive way.
But you're, like, you're a trim person, so you obviously look after yourself. You do your running and sport. So most people, even if they didn't like PE at school, will realize actually in the adult world, I need to be active. I need to manage what I eat. I need to go running a couple of times a week, whatever your thing is. But people are aware that being bad at PE at school doesn't mean that you're going to be, you know, completely inactive. Whereas people with maths, they think, I couldn't do maths at school, wasn't good at numeracy. So therefore, actually, money is something that I can't do either. So we need to change that narrative. Actually, even if you had found maths tricky at school, you can still change your personal finances.
So before we leave, I want to just ask one final question. And that's for someone listening that is in that predicament. You know, they've got that, maybe they've got a child who struggles with numeracy, or they themselves struggling with the financial side of it. What steps can they start to take to overcome that perception that you're bad at it, so you'll always be bad at it?
So actually, I'm going to put on my National Numeracy Charity hat. So on their website, they have almost like an MLT diagnostic. It's called the National Numeracy Challenge. It takes 10 minutes. You can even use a calculator. It's in the real world. You are allowed phones and calculators. And this numeracy test is two things. One is it assesses your attitude towards maths, because that's part of it. If you hate maths and you're afraid of it, that's a big part of the hurdle. And the second part is it looks at basic competency, like your arithmetic skills, your percentage skills, some fraction skills, and then it gives you remedial tools. So I would say, head to the National Numeracy Challenge. You can just search it on any search engine. And that's like an easy 10-minute win. And then from there, you can sort of find your own way from there.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming in. I hope that you've taken a practical piece of advice from this interview with Bobby. it's been amazing to have you there. And I think just hopefully this leaves anyone feeling insecure or afraid, like we said, of numbers, whether you're an adult and it's money numbers or whether you're a child and it's math lessons. Hopefully you can understand that there is a way to turn things around. It's a skill and not a what? A piece of your genetics or
exactly,
whatever it is.
It's a skill.
Thank you very much for coming on today.
Cheers, Gabriel.
Incredible. So that now moves us on to Money Tip of the Week. And I was actually going to give a different piece of advice to one that I've actually just come up with right now. And the piece of advice that I want to share is to stress the point that Bobby was just making about a way to improve your numbers. And that is head to National Numeracy Challenge. Give it a Google and start to look to turn the way you think about numbers. Give it a 180 flip. And for those of you that aren't good at numbers, that basically means turn it around fully. Because I was going to give you something about expenses and budgeting, etc. But I think this is an even better tip. We've got Bobby on. Why not give that as the Money Tip of the Week? Head to National Numeracy. Actually dive in and see if you can turn around your attitude, your perception when it comes to numbers, finances, anxiety, all that kind of stuff. Because it's such an important message. Whether you like it or not, money will interact with your life and numbers will interact with your life forever. So you may as well get this perception out that you're not good. You were good at English. You weren't good at maths. It's irrelevant. Go there, take the challenge, start there and start using the tools and resources they have on their website. That was a real quick change of my Money Tip of the Week. And whatever it was that I was going to say, you'll get it next week. So make sure you tune in for that. Anyway, coming up after this short break, Ben Askins will be in the studio. He is a content creator. He's the co-founder of Gaia and he has been all over social media talking about toxic bosses. I'm excited for this one.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Hey!
FUBAR Radio presents Access
All Areas. Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Oh, yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going for you, Ed, when you put shut? I'm going to shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running round.
Except
like,
you wouldn't be 80 years old. No. You'd be
26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored. Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing "Oh Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience and I was very pleased we did it. We wrote, the office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Every single one said it's really necessary for them to come. The
Dating Show. I'm friends with a fair few exes and I think you can be friends with an ex, but I genuinely do. But I do think that it's timing is everything with that.
Well, I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you talking about someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like if you've already shagged, isn't that a bit weird?
Think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level of friend. You can be friends with someone, you can't be like best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff. But I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone. We are back and I am joined by yet another brilliant guest. We have Ben Askins in the studio. If you haven't heard of him before today, you will have heard of him after today. Well, obviously, because you're listening to this. But Ben Askins is an incredible content creator. But more importantly than that, he's a brilliant entrepreneur. He's had successful businesses in the past. He's currently the co-founder of Gaia, another entrepreneurial pursuit. And more importantly, and where you might recognize him from, is he has gone viral countless times on social media calling out horrible toxic bosses in the workplace. I mean, some of the scenarios and examples that he's been kind of sharing through social media are phenomenal. They're to the point where they actually seem fake, but they've all been sent into him by real people and he calls them out for what they are. I'm not going to use the language that probably he sometimes uses in the videos himself. Anyway, thank you for joining me today, Ben.
Thanks so much, and wow, what an intro.
Yeah, I didn't see that one coming myself, but it was a well-deserved intro. So like I said, you are very well known because of social media and that kind of horrible boss take that you've been doing so well for the past, what, year now, probably?
Yeah, almost exactly a year to today.
There you go. How did, I would say the idea come about, but I want to go back a step even further. How did your social media presence come about? Because obviously your background isn't social media, it's business.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've always been digital because my first business was a digital marketing agency. So I was sort of fairly abreast of what was going on there. However, the reason I started posting was actually I started to see some really poor advice being shared online. And I'm not talking sort of subjective, oh, I kind of see your point. I mean, really poor sort of run your business into ground, like terrible financial decisions sort of advice. And the problem with tech these days is if you've got a little podcast room and you've got some good music and a clever editor, you can make yourself look really convincing. And so my social journey started off just almost responding to some of these videos, just sort of giving, you know, my 2 cents worth of it. And, you know, people started sending me their stories and their own clips. And then someone sent me a recruitment story, which I read out and responded to. And then that sort of opened the doors to the boss stories. And yeah, it all spiraled from there, really.
I like it. So you were there to just tackle misinformation on the internet when it came to, you said, horrible examples of things that are being out there. And you are right. Anyone with a phone can now put something on the internet and make it seem legit, because you don't need to back yourself, you don't need sources, you don't need anything like that, you just need an opinion. And unfortunately some people have horrible opinions.
Yeah, and I think the problem with social is there's 2 ways to go viral on social. You can either be a real expert in your subject matter and sort of gain, I'd say, healthy followers in that sense, or you can go in really hard with really opinionated stuff, and sadly that's the stuff that tends to go viral and get quite clickbaity. And so it's much easier and lazier to go down that route. And I think one of the sort of big pros and cons of social media is the amplification. And if it's the wrong message or an incorrect message, then yeah, you start to enter some quite murky waters.
I want to know, based on your opinions of what you've been reading and putting out there, because there have been so many case studies you've now gone through on your socials. Why do so many of these bosses exist? How do they get into their positions and get the power to do the things and say the things that they do?
Yeah. It's interesting, because I've been sent so many stories, but it's amazing how common the themes are. And one of the most interesting things about it is when I would post a bad boss story, everyone will start commenting, oh, that's definitely the US or the UK, or that's definitely in this sector. And it's amazing how universal bad bosses seem to be, you know, white collar, blue collar, industry, sector, whatever it might be. So I think the kind of core problem comes down to communication and lack of training, because very few people sort of set out to go, right, I'm going to be an awful boss today. I'm going to go out of my way to really make people's lives miserable. And so when you kind of assume, you'd like to assume that most people aren't sociopaths, which would have to be to kind of take that approach, you kind of think, well, hang on, why are there so many? Because the percentage of people who think they're working for their worst boss ever right now is staggering. And so you have to start thinking, you know, why do people think that being such a bad manager? And it has to come down to a competency rather than an intention. And that seems to be the common theme across a lot of my stories.
I feel like there's also another aspect to it, and I don't know if this is something you agree with, but it's this idea of career progression often results in you having to take on managerial responsibilities. And let's say you go into a company very good at a skill. That's how you normally enter the bottom of the ladder, right? Mm. And when you work your way up the ladder, you eventually become a manager just due to the nature of a lot of careers. I know some ways you don't have to and you can maybe become a product specialist, but often it says, you know, you're going upwards, so you now have to start managing people. And being good at your job versus being good at management, I assume are two very different skills.
Very different skills. And also what you have to remember is when you've done your job for a few years, you're pretty good at it. But if it's your first week or two as a manager, you're kind of starting from square one again. And I think the challenge is that a lot of people, their approach will be, right, I'll just copy what my manager did for me. And that's great if they're good. But if they're bad, you inevitably pick up a lot of the bad habits that they did and you don't know any better. And so it kind of spirals from there. And so I think, you know, training and management is one of the most underinvested areas of any business, because I think people get promoted and they think, oh, they've got 5-6 years experience, you know, they'll be fine. And it's amazing how costly that is in the long run for business, because the cost of recruitment's extortionate, the cost of losing good people because of poor management, which is, you know, one of the most common reasons to leave a job. It's costing companies tens of thousands, if not hundreds, by just simply not taking it seriously, which in my mind's, you know, ridiculous.
All right, that leads me on to probably the one question I wanted to ask you more than any other. What's the worst story that has been sent in to you, or, you know, from elsewhere that you've heard of?
So this worse in the sense of that's truly how you've arrived at that decision. That's just mind-blowing. And then that's just kind of like quite sad. You know, you get things like there was a story that got sent in where the sort of building was on literally was on fire and the fire brigade told them we had to evacuate. And the boss was sort of saying, no, we'll just finish off the hour and we'll try and get things done. So you have the sort of truly ridiculous where you're sort of going, you know, you actually have smoke in the room.
And delusion.
Delusion, I think, is a fair way. And then you get the sort of really sort of tragic stories where family members in hospital or, you know, something awful's happened in your personal life where... You know, it's an as a business or an owner or a manager or an entrepreneur, you kind of like personal lives impact professional. That's just if you work for 35 years, that's inevitably going to happen. And you kind of have a choice at that point. And I think as a business, you can either choose to be that business you say you are and stand up and support your team in those moments, or you just go out of your way to make it completely worse. And there's no sort of in between. You kind of have to pick one or the other. And I think the short-sightedness of some people who sort of say, no, you can't go see your dying mum in hospital, or, you know, the worst one is when someone's have to leave the building and they're being badgered because they're at a funeral and they're having messages from their boss chasing on inane sort of it's utterly unacceptable. And yeah, I have a healthy level of contempt for people who do that.
You've been a boss yourself, right?
Yes.
I mean, that is your experience. That's how you're able to give your opinion on a lot of these matters. Are you reading these thinking, oh, you know, like I was actually not a great boss at the start myself. I had a few incompetencies and, you know, I've managed to grow into a good boss. Or at the end of the day, is most of this stuff you look at it and you go like, even as a complete newbie, like I just use common sense and I would avoid pretty much every one of these problems.
No, God, I mean, a lot of my advice comes from sort of mistakes. I mean, I'd like to think that some of the really worst cases I avoided, but, you know, I've been managing people since the age of 22 when my first business started. And, you know, no one's a good manager at 22. And, you know, I had a huge learning curve and made a lot of mistakes. And, you know, I'd like to think I'm quite self-reflective now, but certainly for a few years, I sort of bouldered my way through management in a way where I thought I was probably doing a lot better than I actually was. So no, I would never, you know, I'd like to think I'm better than I was for sure, but in regards to whether I'm a good boss, I guess you'd have to ask some of my team.
Well, we can test you right now because we can do a live toxic boss reaction. Before you came on today, we asked the audience to send in any of their own toxic boss storylines. And this one was sent in, we'll keep the person anonymous, which you do as well. I think it makes sense. We don't want them to lose their job or whatever it is. Their father actually lost their job. And upon being told that they were leaving the company, were asked or told, in fact, that they had to delete all contacts or networking, like people that they'd kind of networked with throughout 20 years at the company. So this guy said it included people that he was now the godfather of and people that were his best friends that he'd made literally through 20 years being part of this company. And they took it one step further. They told him that he had to go on Zoom and live stream him deleting the contacts out of his phone book. Because their reason was they were worried he would go off and, you know, compete with the business and take them elsewhere.
I mean, look, the problem I have with sort of companies who make decisions like this is it's so short-sighted and idiotic. Because if you take that example, so firstly, look, non-competes are quite standard in a contract. So there's often sort of a six-month gardening leave where you say, right, you can't hire anyone from the business you left or you can't compete with any clients. And I'm totally okay with that. But the idea you can take a 20-year career, which, by the way, he's given you, not as much as you've given them to him, he's given you. The idea that you can just take that and sort of say, right, you can now remove everyone you've built a contact with and I'm going to make you do it. And then the lack of trust on top of that to sort of show, because bear in mind, they've got rid of him. So, like, they're not obviously not valuing him a huge amount if they've got rid of him. And on top of that, say, right, not only are we going to take you away, we're going to take away all your network and your infrastructure to get a new job, basically. Because what he's basically saying is saying, right, we're firing you. And on top of that, we're going to go out of our way to not help you get a new job, and which I think you should do. You know, if you fire someone, it's obviously an awful decision to make. And, you know, it happens and there's a lot of legitimate ways to do that. But the least you can do is try and facilitate them getting a job. I've never heard a company to go out of their way to say, actually, I'm going to make this harder and make you delete all of your contacts. That's utterly ludicrous.
And to actually record it so they could actually physically see the person doing
just,
it.
It's just wild. And also, even that, if you really were that suspicious, you could still... that's crazy. That's absolutely mind-blowing.
I mean, like, if it was me in that scenario being the one fired, those contacts are being duplicated onto another resource, like, straight before
and also
that Zoom call.
You've got LinkedIn, you've got all this sort of thing. It's impossible what they're suggesting. All you can do is you can have non-competes, but also if you fired him, no, waive your non-competes. Like, come on. I think this is the big point between sort of like making legitimate business decisions, because everyone always thinks my channel's just calling out bad bosses. And 100% it's a part of that, because I do think some of the behavior is appalling. But I always maintain it's a good advice from a business manager, entrepreneur, financial perspective, because What do you think he said? So when someone says, oh, because it's a very small world, the sectors you're in, everyone sort of knows everyone. So when someone says, oh, you work there, what did you like it? What do you think he's going to say? Do you see what I mean? Like, it's so short-sighted, you just damage your reputation, which impacts your recruitment, which inevitably hits your bottom line. So, yeah, I mean, zero sympathy, but also terrible business decision what they've done there.
Right, let's shift gears a little bit. I've hit you with a lot of horrible boss stuff, which okay. I know is kind of your bread and butter, but you have other knowledge. You know, you're an entrepreneur, you're a businessman. You look at the workplace generally when it comes to, you know, the current trends in the economy and all that kind of stuff. Something I want to talk to you about is this label being stuck on Gen Zs and young people, how they are, you know, lazy. I mean, if you ever watch anything on social media and, you know, day in the life working at Google, first I go in and I make my breakfast and then I go to a yoga class being put on. And then, you know, I do it, send a few emails and then I go home. Obviously, that's a real one-off case scenario. But do you think it's a fair assumption, unfair assumption, this way that Gen Zs are generally quoted when it comes to the workplace?
Completely and utterly unfair. It makes zero sense to me. And because when you actually think about it logically, it couldn't make less sense, this idea that a generation is now lazy. Because there's two scenarios here. Either something's going wrong culturally where generation is struggling in the workplace, which is option one. Or option two is humans have evolved over one generation to become, by default, lazy, which feels unlikely. And the problem I have is if one or two or a few people are feeling, you know, identified, like, 'cause there's lazy people in every generation, right? But if there's just a few, you could say, right, that's just the default. If it gets to the point where there's 60, 70, 80% of the workforce which is disillusioned, there has to be a problem with the work, right? There has to be something going on culturally or society, because you can't, it's not just a whole generation just becoming completely lazy. It just doesn't make sense to me. And so this idea, when I hit see, because I you know, I obviously get the stories and a lot of my audience is younger or sort of in the first two jobs, and they sort of come out and you've got to think about what they've gone through. They've gone through, you know, COVID, like that, you know, no one's had a, you know, education like they have in the sense of how COVID disrupted it. They've come into the workforce, it's a cost of living crisis. Good luck getting a house anytime in the next 4 or 5 decades. And they're sort of sitting here going, yeah, you got to grind, you got to work, you got to do this, and you got to appreciate it. And I think the hope element's key. I think if you take hope out of a workforce, you do start inevitably going to impact morale. And so, yeah, no, I struggle with that argument because I think it's quite lazy from people who say it, ironically.
Yeah, and you can always just respond by saying, you try to get a job at Google.
Well, exactly. I mean, I did a piece of content the other day where I went through some grad schemes. It's the most frustrating hour of my life. So I actually sat there and said, right, I've made up a CV because my grades wouldn't have got me anywhere near the qualification thing. And I went through and I did all these applications and I did the questionnaires, and it was the most frustrating hours. It took an hour each one. I did three. Most frustrating hours of my life.
Got it.
I was seething. And I had no skin in the game. I obviously didn't need that, wasn't looking for a job, but I was so angry.
You're giving me horrible flashbacks right now, because yeah, I went through about 40 of those in my final year of uni.
And so you sort of throw that on top, and then you come in, you go, right, you got a graduate class of 80, but there's only 30 jobs at the end. So you think, right, so that's 50 22-year-olds whose first experience of the workplace is being fired or let go or run into the ground so they quit. Great. But, you know, be happy, work harder.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does my head in. It's on a company to create an environment where people want to work. So,
absolutely. So the government are bringing out a new flexible working bill, mm-hmm. or trying to at the moment. This idea that you get the right to kind of get a bit more flexibility from day one. So you can kind of include that in an agreement. Firstly, what do you think of that as an idea? And secondly, what do you think, according to the kind of like opinion of people that say they might be scared to even bring this up and approach their boss when it comes to this flexible working? Because, you know, the moment you start to show that as your opinion, you might kind of be looked over, or if you bring that up, you know, in an interview, that's something you're after, you're just going to be someone else is just going to be chosen ahead of you, right? So yeah, let's start with good idea, bad idea.
Very good idea. I think everyone likes choice, right? And my entire entrepreneur sort of premise is that if you want to grow, you need a motivated team, you need an inspired team, you need a team that enjoy their work and want to work hard for you. And then I view it as this on the entrepreneur, or the business owner, or the manager to create their environment in order to work hard. And people like choice. People have always liked choice. And so this idea, because I see people go, oh, people can't learn working from home. It's like, yes, of course they can. Like, if your business genuinely can't teach anything unless they're next to you, that's a failure on your part. I love the hybrid system. I think that works really well, because I'm a big fan of the office. I love spending time in the office. I totally buy into the culture building elements and all of that. But I also totally buy into the fact that sometimes it's nice just to crack through, not deal with
on
the
a
tube,
Friday.
But, yeah,
let's stay at home.
Monday, or where you can just crack through stuff and get your task list. And this idea that you can't manage people remotely is ludicrous, because by that logic, you know, any office with multiple locations immediately fails. So that just doesn't add up. But yeah, I think hybrid's great. I think solutions are always good. In regards to like advice on how to approach it, yeah. I think the best weapon you have in your arsenal is through like numbers. So if it's a sort of set up in a business, if lots of you ask, people are more likely to say, okay, that's quite a good idea. The other thing to put, whereas if competitors are doing it and your company's not, like, you're going to run the risk of losing people anyway. So I think strength in numbers in that regard. But yeah, totally for it. I think it's a no-brainer.
So that idea of being scared to even approach your boss and ask them because of the fear of getting let go or bringing that up in an interview, I suppose the whole point of this bill, right, is that you get the job and then you're allowed to bring it up,
yeah,
rather than the other way around.
It's so tough, because I would immediately say if this is a topic you're generally fearful of raising for your boss, you've got the wrong boss. Like,
or
if he's that irrational about that, he's going to be irrational about other things, and you've got kind of bigger and deeper issues. It's a very reasonable thing to say, what's the company policy on flexible work? Because it should be in your job description, if I'm being honest. Mm. I mean, recruiters and HR people at the early stage should be highlighting benefits,
along with
packages,
full salary transparency.
Of course,
I'm just going to throw that
yeah,
one in there.
Absolutely, because honestly, the amount of times you see people say, "Oh, I interviewed for a job," and then it turned out
range like 20 to 60k.
Yeah, but even someday you even have ranges, and you end up like wasting hours of your life in interviews, and you go, "Hang on, that's like 90% below of what I was sort of."
Just make an account and blast all people. Just do it.
No, exactly. but yeah, I think in regards to this, again, if you raise it at an interview and they genuinely lose respect for you as a candidate, that's the wrong company for you as well, yeah, and they're going to struggle in other areas. So I think it's totally okay. I really do encourage people to ask it, and yeah, keep going.
Okay, one last question that I want to ask you, away from the extremities. If let's say you're in a position, a managerial position, how can you make yourself a good boss? Simple as. What are the key things?
I mean, look, it comes down, it's a personal relationship, okay? In the same way, you know how to treat people. Everyone does. You know, we do it all the time in all of aspects of our life. So just a little bit of transparency in communication is the first step. So have a bit of structure. If you're an unorganized person, because everyone's got strengths and weaknesses, right? And if you're unorganized, spend a bit more time on organization. If you're, you know, feel like you're not bringing enough energy, like focus on the weaknesses. But in general, it's got to be about communication. So just make sure you carve out enough time. Once every 2 weeks, have a one-on-one with all your team. And let me be very clear, that one-on-one is not a status report. It's not, if you want to have one of those, have set one of those up. This is about time for them to tell you what's wrong, because it's amazing how many managers just try and guess. You've got your whole team there. All you have to do is take them into a room and say, look, talk to me, safe space. What can I do to help you out? Where are you struggling? Where can I offer you support? But it's mad. People will spend, like, I've seen companies spend tens of thousands on like these extortionate consultants who try and guess what this is. It's like, just ask them, what can I do for you? It's a personal relationship. It's really not that hard. But if you just carve out the time and make sure you do take it seriously, yeah, you'll be amazed how easy it is.
You make it sound easy.
I truly believe it's not that hard. It's just, it's a mindset as much as anything else.
I think that's a brilliant place to leave people with. If you're in a position, a managerial position, just speak to them like they're humans. And if you're on the other end of it, speak to your boss like they're a human as well, and maybe you can get that relationship built. Well, Ben, thank you very much for your time.
I think I've learned a lot.
I think that everyone listening has learned a lot. And yeah, do go check him out on socials. The stuff is great that you put out. I am a big fan.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. And that now moves us on to our next segment, Scam of the Week. Yeah, that is quite literally what it sounds like, by the way, people. I will tell you about things that I think are a scam when it comes to your world of finances, and we will call them out for what they are. And this one, guess who's got me really upset? It's supermarkets, any of them. Your Tesco's, your Sainsbury's. Okay, I do shop at some of them, okay? What is it about them that have got me so angry? It's the loyalty schemes. So, you know, you go into, I don't know, Tesco. Sorry, Tesco, for picking on you. And you see that big yellow sticker that is like, oh, club card loyalty. You can buy your milk for £1 instead of £7.50 if you're a loyalty, a club card member. Like, it drives my nut in, because it should be £1. No one should be paying £7.50. And why do I need to give you my data to spend £7, like to not spend £7.50 on milk? I mean, I don't know if you're watching this, if anyone's watching this, wants to kind of throw in what they think at the moment. But it boils my blood that there's kind of these inflated prices, and you know, now that every single supermarket I've ever had to shop at has my personal data because I just wanted to buy one thing for a normal price. It doesn't feel like they're discounts anymore for being a loyal customer. It seems like you can spend the normal price by being a loyal, like giving them your details. And if you don't give them your details, you must spend extortionate amounts on everything. Obviously, my example wasn't accurate. I don't have the specific data, but it grinds my gears. It's something that's a massive scam. I'm still falling kind of foul to the scam in the fact that I am now a member of pretty much every single supermarket, and I will kind of scan it to make sure I get the discounted prices because I'm not going to pay more. Yeah, whatever, take my data. But like, it's just like we need more regulation and more supervision of these supermarkets, that if you are going to take my data, give me something in return. Don't charge me for not taking my data, if that makes sense. I get angry on this show sometimes, don't I? Let me take a little bit of a cool down by answering some of the questions. So every week at the end of the show, I will be answering the questions that you DM us or that you ask live whilst I'm recording this. Any question you have, I can answer it. Remember, DM us at Money Out, at That Money Show. I will look at every single one, and the ones that are most relevant, I will answer. And this is your call to action to not be embarrassed about any question. This is the whole point of the show, is like, I want you to ask those questions you think are far too stupid and that you're kind of like worried that people would judge you about asking those questions. So some of the ones we've had in, and these are really good. I want to answer this one from Lola. She says, my boss has offered me a promotion, which is great. However, this would take my salary just over £50,000, which is over the tax threshold, meaning I would now enter that 40% tax bracket. Should I be concerned about this? Genuinely, you might not believe this listening to this, but this is one of the biggest mistakes that people make when it comes to money. They think that going into a higher tax bracket means that their entire salary is now taxed at that amount. So let me give you an example of that. If you're earning £49,000, you currently are in the 20% tax bracket. If you move into £51,000, you are now being taxed at 40%. Not your entire salary, okay? Just the amount you're earning over the threshold gets taxed at that amount. In other words, no, you will earn more. You will be earning more money, okay? You do not need to be concerned. There is some scenarios with child benefits that you should look into. So if you are receiving child benefits and it is affected by your pay, then do look into those specific cases. But for pretty much everyone else, more money equals more money. I know it sounds silly, but it's the truth. And that's a really important lesson. There are thousands of people that make this mistake every single year. Don't be one of them. Next question from Lila. She said, I'm 21 and just finished university. I'm really struggling to find a job, so my parents have suggested I claim benefits whilst I look. I'm living at home, so would I be entitled to anything? Do you know what? My knowledge of the benefits system isn't too strong, but I'm fairly certain that once you're of employed age, it's nothing to do with where you live. If you're unemployed, you're unemployed. You need to live somewhere, right? If I'm wrong, I do strongly apologize, but just head down, speak to, you know, your local council. You can call them if you can ever get through on the phone lines. And just a quick Google online should tell you the answer. But you can claim benefits if you are unemployed. But please do look into the technicalities and remember to don't use that as an excuse to not, you know, actively find a job. Unless, you know, there are specific scenarios. I'm not trying to like pick on people. I am just generalizing here. And the last question that I want to answer is from Freddie. And Freddie says that the economy is awful. I never seem to have any money. It might be a dumb question, but why can't we just print more money? The government are constantly printing new money. Why can't we just print more money and give it to everyone else? That's inflation. If everyone gets more money, no one gets more money, yeah? So if everyone suddenly gets, you know, £100 more, it's kind of like that idea that if you just print money into a system, we're going to get back to that inflation situation we had, at the moment, but not as bad, but about a year or two ago. More money means people spend more money, which means the prices of things go up, which means inflation happens, yada, yada, yada. You get the point. They do print more money. It's called quantitative easing, if you want to look into that term a little bit. That's economics GCSE or A-level for those of you interested. They have to just be sensible with it, okay? Hopefully that answers your question. So that kind of brings us to the end of what I think has been an amazing show, genuinely. Obviously, we cover some things in the economy, so hopefully you have that kind of picture of what's going on this week. We also spoke to Bobby Seagal and spoke about this idea that, you know, when it comes to numeracy, you're not good or bad. It's a skill that can still be honed. You might just be a bit slower than other people, but that's with anything in life, right? And finances and numbers are such a fundamental part of your life that it's nothing. Don't just ignore it because you're scared of it, because like Bobby actually mentioned, you can often pass that on to future generations. So instead, if you want to head to the website I said earlier, I think it was the National Numeracy Challenge, a quick Google to kind of, you know, try out, see where you are when it comes to your numbers and, you know, benefit off the back of that. But remember, again, you can just start to educate yourself on personal finances, you know, budgeting, Excel, these things can do the math for you. Something that Bobby mentioned as well, calculators are allowed in the real world. Just because you weren't allowed them in exams doesn't mean you aren't allowed them in the real world. So take advantage of that and start, well, stop being afraid of numbers. And then also thank you to Ben who jumped on. And you know what? He just, basically, if you have ever managed someone, if you're currently a manager or ever want to go into that position, just download what he's saying and really digest it. At the end of the day, it kind of does just sound like common sense, but apparently people don't have common sense. So maybe it's something you actually have to actively learn. This idea that, remember, your boss is a person and the person that you are the boss of is also a human being. Treat them like that. Understand that, you know, as much of a priority as you want them their job to be, it's still like they have their own life, they have their own family, there are things that are more important than work. I'm sorry to those of you that disagree with that, but it's just true. There are things more important. So take that, download it. And like I said, if you have any questions, do send them in, DM That Money Show. That is it for today. We will see you next week for another jam-packed show. I have been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show. We'll see you next week.